he did was to start off at 420 and assign 6 megacycle channels from 420 to 450, assuming that the ATV people would someday be using every single one of them. And since the carrier is set off 1.25 megacycles from the low end of the channel with the usual decidual sideband AM television transmission, so that's how the 439.25 came about. So it was a naive person assuming that the whole band would be filled up with amateur television someday. He completely forgot about the sideband and the FM people. And I do remember when I first got on 432, let me drop. And I guess it was around 1969. Getting there wasn't easy. Commercial equipment for ham radio use essentially didn't exist. Guys were taking 450 meg taxi rigs and converting them and putting out numbers like 50 watts, but a real 432 high power transmitter, you had to homebrew it. And we thought that we were up in the never-never frequencies in those days. Nowadays, the guys that are in the never-never frequencies are on 80 gigahertz and 241 gigahertz, and those are official ham bands. And yes, there are guys doing that work among those serious microwave operators I told you about, with us, roughly 4 of them per million in the general population. And you speak about subcultures. Boy, is that a subculture. But amateur television, I'm a little bit disappointed by the fact that, let me drop. The majority of guys who get into amateur television are the fairly mature individuals where they've tried a hell of a lot of other kinds of ham radio. As such, they tend to be the white-haired people, and unfortunately, quite a number of them have become silent keys, and I think another one was lost just this week. But when you see amateur television, that can be fun. I do remember, I'm having trouble remembering his call letters now, a guy who lived in Amityville. He had, in those days, what we called a portable camera, great big Vidicon camera with a great big long cable behind it. But he would go walking around his house and his property with his camera on his shoulder. And as you sat in your QTH looking at the pictures he's transmitting, you felt like you were living his life. You saw what he saw. You heard what he heard. You see his hands in front of the camera as he's walking around the house, picking up objects, telling you what he's working on, showing you the things. Then he walks outside, tilts his body back, and aims the camera up the tower, and you see the tower that contains the antenna that's transmitting the signal that you are watching. It was quite an interesting operation. He also would periodically transmit tape recordings of the flooding that he got in his Amityville property. And I do remember one particular scene, let me drop, where he was floating his rowboat up and down the street in front of his house because the water had risen that high. And he made that recording, and he put some music in the background, Surfing USA, and played that to us. He would also start his broadcast with the Star Spangled Banner being played and the flag waving. The guys on 432, they bend the rules a little bit. Yeah, ham radio operators are not supposed to transmit music. But obviously that was a series of test tones measuring the linearity of the system. I'm bending the truth a little bit here. But when you're on a band that high in those days, 432 megs, and no one else is around, and the fact that you're transmitting some music is a very minor infraction of the rules. It's a victimless crime as I see it. You transmit music on the single sideband portion of 80 meters, and you're creating a real crime. You're making a nuisance of yourself. You're taking up too much bandwidth with something that isn't real ham radio, if you know what I mean. But on 432 or 80 gigahertz, if you transmit music or computer programs or whatever, there's no real problem with that as I see it. Anyone else, any further questions? I'm going to pass it open to you guys as to what your field day was like. And John, I'd like to know if you had a chance to visit some of the field day sites in Richmond County, better known as Staten Island. So KC2WGB to take it with a pause if anyone else wants to tell us what their field day was like. K2RYW on the TechNet.
KC2 QIQ with a different topic though, Dick.
Glenn recognized, and okay. You think you've got a point of order, an important enough topic that we should come up with it right now, Glenn? KC2.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2 QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just kind of continuing along with something. I received a video, a YouTube email from Wesley, and this one really kind of caught my eye. And the title of it is called X-ray diffraction, and it's really worth seeing. And I think the one part that you'd really appreciate is about 8 minutes into this YouTube video, the title comes up, what is a light wave? And the description that that this guy Michael McBride makes, where he describes the wavelength as a force on a particle. Dick, you have to see this. I think this will explain a lot of the things that we were going back and forth on, and he just puts the perfect words to it. He's got the pictorial video in the background. You just can't beat this one. This one's precious. KC2 QIQ.
Okay, I look forward to that one. A force on a particle is what a light wave is, okay? A light wave is just a higher frequency than a radio wave. It's all part of the exact same spectrum. Does that give you a feeling, Glenn, that a radio wave is also a force on a particle? You and I have had some discussions that I've gotten some favorable mail out of that, by the way, where I've got this theory that the majority of electromagnetic wave is really magnetic. And I don't think there's very much electronics to it until it hits a conductor. But that's a theory. I haven't proven it. So is a radio wave also a force on a particle? What do you think, Glenn? KC2 QIQ, are we finally going to explain what a radio wave is? KC2 LAW, you can take that.
Well, as I said, you really have to see this video. I can put words to it, but in a nutshell, the electromagnetic wave spectrum, whether it's light, radio frequency, X-ray, the electromagnetic wave is the force. It's the force on, in this particular discussion, he talks about the charged electron particle. And the way he describes it is he takes, because it's really part of a chemistry class, and what he's trying to explain here, and I said, when you see this video, you'll see everything snap into gear, exactly how he's explaining the wave and how its effect on a particle is. And then basically the energy or the force on the object, which is the charged particle. A beautiful explanation. So I couldn't have done it better myself. Yes, and definitely the electromagnetic wave, as opposed to the light wave, it's just different frequency. And he explains that as part of wavelength here. And he does a beautiful job of it. Let me just stop for a minute and let it drop. As far as the magnetic portion of an electromagnetic light wave, yes, it is there. But the reason why the impact of the electromagnetic wave when we discuss the electron is so much more important than the magnetic part is because of the mass of the electron as opposed to the mass of the rest of the atom is so much lighter. So when you have the E field affecting the electron, you have the real motivator. And that's really the nutshell. And if you watch this video and the way he explains it, it's really wonderful. This one's very, very special.
So if an electromagnetic wave, and now I'm going to go to a radio wave, is a force on a particle, and particularly a charged particle, and I'm talking about a radio wave coming from an astronaut on the moon toward the Earth, and that radio wave is traveling through the hardest vacuum that you and I can imagine. The translunar space between Earth and Moon is a very hard vacuum. You and I could argue whether or not there are any particles there. I think there are none. You think there are some, I believe. I think there is essentially nothing in that vacuum. No electrons, no protons, no particles. So if the electromagnetic wave is a force on a particle and there are no particles there, and the propagation of that wave from the moon back to the Earth into my dish and allowed me to listen to the Apollo 15 and 16 astronauts becomes a little bit more spooky. I'm going to give that back to you, Glenn, for some comments. KC2 QIQ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Hey, Glenn, I don't think I saw that. If you could email it to me, I would appreciate it also. Thank you.
Yeah, the video is it's called number 5 X-ray diffraction, and when you go into it about, watch the whole thing, but the part that I'm talking about comes in about 8 minutes into this one. It's really wonderful. And as far as the electromagnetic wave by itself, it's just a four stick. That's really what it amounts to. And when you watch this video, he explains it beautifully. The guy's name is Michael McBride, and at Yale University, and he has beautiful pictorial in the background, and he explains it exactly as the electromagnetic wave being a force. And the particle is the mass part. And then the interreaction is sometimes like with respect to light, as we talk about the photon. But he goes into such detail of explaining the different frequencies and the wavelengths because that this is a chemistry class that I think it's going to answer every question that you have, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Going to answer every question that I've got. Well, even the one about Raquel Welch. Never mind. I sent an email to a bunch of guys this last week. Well, the latest issue of QST, the July issue, in the Doctor is In section, the second submittal there, was talking about using a directional wattmeter in the transmission line. And whether it should go between the exciter and the amplifier and the antenna tuner and the antenna. Well, where's the right place to use the bird wattmeter, so to speak? Let me drop it. And so it is my impression that the wording of that answer was a little bit too restrictive. And so some people would be afraid to use a bird wattmeter in places that I think it's very useful. And so I wrote a little article about that, sent it off. I've already gotten a very nice answer, by the way, from the column, the person who runs that column. But I sent copies of it to the guys on Long Island, including Glenn. I guess I got to give you a copy of the answer that I got. And so if they want more information, it's a good soon, good time. So when you're calling it a force, it's a force that is so light. I mean, if it was a significant force, we would be immediately setting up solar sails and getting a whole lot of power out of it. My impression, let me drop it, is any spacecraft that's powered by a solar sail is really running on flea power. You can have a zillion square meters of sail and you get flea power out of it. So, not a very potent force, but force is one thing to call it. Okay, it's going to answer all my questions. I'm going to watch that video, Glenn. I'm going to come back to you and say, are you sure it answered all my questions? I'm having some fun with your words. Don't take it too seriously. But I did want to know, John, did you get a chance to go to any of the field day operations? We know that Paul did. We know that Glenn did. We know that I did. And many of the other guys involved. So did you get a chance, or were you a little bit too busy? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, I didn't have that pleasure. I was stuck here at the house with the laborers and the plumbers over the weekend making some changes to the sewer line, so I wasn't able to do that.
Okay. To many a Sirius ham radio operator on the HF bands, the field day operation is the high holy days. That's pretty sacred. The family is told ahead of time and don't depend on the ham radio operator being available that weekend. That it's going to be they're going to be dedicated to this particular operation. The VHFers, the UHFers, and the microwavers, they got their different version. They've got their yearly meeting called the Microwave Update, and it moves around the country. It was really invented by my mind's going blank. I can't remember the name of the guy who invented the Microwave Update, and those were held in Colorado at the National Bureau of Standards for quite a number of years. And it eventually became a thing that moved around the country. And so you get 100 or so guys, 150 guys that are very interested in that subject all coming together, who all know each other on a first-name basis because they've been communicating on the microwave. years. And so if any of them needs, could you have any of them needs a schematic, a module, a voltage controlled oscillator, a dielectric resonator oscillator, if they need any of the crazy things, a traveling wave tube power supply, a klystron, a magnetron, if any of these guys need any of the serious microwave hardware, software, firmware, whatever, they share it with each other and they share information and let me think now. Essentially every single day there's communication among them that takes place, even including subjects like unidentified flying objects. That's another whole subject I won't get into right now, but a certain number of the microwave operators have seen things in the sky that are difficult to explain. That's an easy way of explaining it. So there's some interesting subcultures among the ham radio enthusiasts of the 26 kinds of ham radio. There are even guys now who have succeeded in bouncing a microwave signal off of the International Space Station and doing far over the horizon communication. I ran a quick experiment with a guy in Louisiana once. Let me drop with that great big 16 Yagi array of mine on 432, in which we were going to bounce the signal from the of the space shuttle, but didn't get a chance to carry that one out. And now these experiments, I've experimented with bouncing 10 gigahertz signals off the World Trade Center and the Verrazano Bridge, and gotten some real nice reflected signals. So building bounce reflection mode of microwave communication is a reality. Alrighty, anyone with further questions or comments on all of the above, what you experienced during the field day operation, what you've heard tonight you want to comment on, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Hey, these guys put in such a heavy weekend with field day, and some guys go around the clock with the whole operation. I could tell because I left those guys at 4 in the morning and they were still, each one of the tents were going strong, making QSOs. Heard lots of Morse code and other things in the background. Sideband Morse code. So, I guess these guys are tired. What else should we be discussing? And if the answer is nothing, maybe you've got one more mailbag object we should go through, John. K2RIW listening. Give me your call letters and name if you haven't signed in earlier.
Dick, maybe you want to cover a subject you were speaking about last week, the SWR and the transmission cable from the transmitter to the antenna, and you were going to have that with Hal. Maybe you'd want to elaborate on that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, I guess this is as good a time as any. A little bit unfortunate that Hal may not be here tonight, K6WPZ. Delta Papa Zulu, yeah. I think it's his call letters. Right there. My mind's left all day tonight. Yeah, Hal. Delta Papa Zulu. Dark Purple Zombies. Yeah, we got the right guy. Hal has said for lots of years that he believes in adjusting the length of the transmission line to find that magic length where the standing wave ratio disappears. I pretty strongly disagree with him most of the time. But there is a place where Hal is right, to some degree. If I have a thoroughly balanced antenna as load on the end of a transmission line, and if I'm feeding it in a proper manner with reference to a balun, in other words, by way of the balun at the end of a coaxial cable, you force the unbalanced coaxial cable to properly feed a balanced antenna, like a dipole or a driven element of a Yagi, for instance, in such a way that you're double darn sure you're not launching any signal back down on the outside of the cable. Let me drop. And the classic way this comes about, we all have done this. We've taken the coaxial cable. At the end of it, we broke out the shield and the center conductor. And we're feeding a dipole. And we connect the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole. And we connect the center conductor to the right side of the dipole. We've all done that. And it feeds the dipole very nicely. Mother Nature's got a couple of tricks up her sleeve. That dipole antenna, she considers it a thoroughly balanced antenna. She wants that antenna to be fed in such a way that at the instant of time that you're putting a positive voltage on the right side of the dipole, on that half of the RF cycle, when you put a positive voltage on the left-hand side, she wants you to put a negative voltage on the left-hand side in a thoroughly balanced manner. If you're putting plus 10 volts on the right side, you're going to put minus 10 volts on the left side. At first, you think to yourself that why do I have to balance the voltage? Let me go one step further and tell you what's really going on here. You may think naively you're putting opposite polarity voltage on the two halves of the dipole. It looks like you're doing that. But that transmission line is really conveying the energy from your transmitter. And if you're smart enough, you could build a micro-miniature transmitter, put it in the middle of the dipole, and there's no transmission line at all. It's just the right-hand side of the box has the right-hand side of the dipole connected to it, going through an insulator, and the left side is the same thing. The transmitter really is a pump. When you're putting positive voltage on the right side and negative voltage on the left side, you're really supplying electrons that create a current toward the left side, and you're subtracting electrons from the right side. When you put positive voltage on the right side, you're really subtracting electrons from that side. When you put negative voltage on the left side, you're putting negative electrons. You're putting electrons on that side. So you're really pumping energy from once. You're pumping current, charged particles, from one side of the dipole to the other. It is a one-dimensional operation during each half cycle. It's not opposite polarity. If you look at it in a voltage point of view, you come up with the wrong answer. If you look at it from a current point of view, you now realize that you've got maximum current in the center, and the current flowing in the center is all in one direction of this half cycle. Mother Nature wants it to be that way. Let me drop. As such, she really thinks that what you call a dipole is a half of an antenna with reference to the universe on the right side, and have the other half of the antenna with reference to the universe on the other side. She wants it to be fed in a balanced manner. She will force voltage on the left side, even though you've connected the shield there and you think you're putting nothing there. As such, there will be current flowing down the outside of the cable. Therefore, what you think is antenna is really the thing that you call the radiator, the dipole, plus the feed line. The feed line is now got current, RF current flowing on it, and it is radiating. And it's part of the antenna, it's part of the resonator. Let me drop. So you think you've made your radiator to dipole a half wave long. It's not. It's a half wave long plus some fraction of the transmission line, because the transmission line is part of the radiating system. And every antenna with reference to, with a couple of small exceptions, every antenna you and I build is a standing wave structure. There's a lot of energy bouncing back and forth on each half cycle before it becomes radiated. And so that energy is bouncing back and forth on the dipole itself and on the shield of the outside of the coax cable if you connect it without a balance. Therefore, as you change the length of the transmission line, you're changing the length of the radiating system and moving it up and down in resonance. As you move it up and down in resonance, in a cyclic manner, if you keep changing the length of the cable. There are some magic lengths of cable where the extra reactance of the radiating system, meaning the outside of the coax cable, coupled to the dipole, that whole combination of system, can now give you a much lower standing wave ratio at certain lengths of the transmission line. So, yes, there is a way of adjusting the transmission line to make improvements of the standing wave ratio when you're improperly feeding a dipole without a balance. Let me jump. Now let's go to the pure sense. If I've got either real balanced twin lead feeding the antenna, or if I've really got coaxial cable going into a perfect RF choke, which could be a good number of turns of the coax cable at the end, held together with tape, you know, a poor man's balance, or a real balance. As long as you've got a real balance there and you're feeding the dipole in a balanced manner that it wants to be fed, and now you're doubled on sure for couple of different reasons. There is no current flowing down the outside of the coax cable, and now the length of the cable is not part of the radiating system. In that particular circumstance, because your antenna presents some particular impedance, which is almost never a perfect 50-ohm resistor with reference to 50-ohm cable, and particularly when there's a band like the 80-meter band or the 20-meter band, which has got a significant amount of frequency range over which it works, even though you may have a perfect Vizwa match of the antenna in the center of the band, somewhere else in the band, it's not a good match. Let me drop it. So therefore, somewhere in the band, you've got a less than perfect match in almost every situation. Less than a perfect match means, by the laws of physics, the way the transmission line works, that signal goes down the transmission line, hits less than a perfect 50-ohm resistor, and some percentage of it will be reflected from the antenna at some particular predictable phase angle. That energy will be reflected back down the cable. Of the energy that comes back down the cable, assuming the cable is low in loss, it has a particular magnitude of reflection coefficient. You can represent that in at least three different ways. You can talk about the exact amount of standing wave ratio. You can talk about the exact amount of dBm or watts of reflected power. You can talk about the rho, the Greek letter usually used for reflection coefficient of voltage, or you could talk about the reflection coefficient of current. All of them are the same thing, just different systems of units for expressing it. But the bottom line is, a given amount of predictable energy is coming back down the cable because you've put a less than perfect load at the end of that cable. And except for the amount of insertion loss the cable has, which I'll ignore right now, the fact that you make that cable in that ideal situation longer or shorter has absolutely no effect on the reflection coefficient. So therefore, if the cable is low enough in loss, the amount of energy that goes back down that cable, comes back into the shack on the inside of the cable, that amount of energy does not change just because you decide to change the length of that transmission line. As you change the length of the transmission line, what you get arrives a little bit sooner or later in the time domain, which means you're going to get a slightly different phase angle of that voltage coming back down. But you're...
Repeater, timeout.
So to repeat, you're going to change the phase angle when you change the length, but you're not changing the specific magnitude of the amount that comes back down. You're not changing the standing wave ratio. You're only changing the phase angle. So, certain lengths of cable with a slightly mismatched transmitter may give you a little bit better coupling between the two if you're not using an antenna tuner. Also, changing the length of the cable changes the phase angle of reflection, therefore changes whether or not your solid-state amplifier is stable or unstable. There are certain kinds of bipolar Mirage 1016, for instance, amplifier, with certain length of cable going to your mag mount in the car, might become unstable. And by way of you changing the length of the cable going to that mag mount, you're changing the phase angle of the reflected signal at various frequencies, and in many cases will take an unstable bipolar brick amplifier and convert it into a stable one. So that's not changing the Vizwa magnitude. It's changing the phase angle and changing the stability of the system. So when Hal says that he can change the length of the cable and improve the Vizwa, only in an improper operation without a balance, in my opinion, but yes, it does take place. But if the system is used in a more ideal manner, I think that you cannot change the Vizwa by changing the length of the cable. You've got to readjust the antenna impedance itself. And there is some magic that's a well-kept secret that I'm going to reveal to you again right now. Let me drop. And that is, a well-kept secret is that you can make your dipole present any impedance you like. You throw your dot at the Smith chart, and it lands somewhere in the middle of the Smith chart, or off to one side of the Smith chart, that represents a certain resistive component and reactive component. You tell me whatever component you like, whatever spot on that Smith chart, and you allow me to do two very simple operations. You allow me to change the length of the dipole, and you allow me to change the reactor across the center of the dipole. Those two very simple operations, and I can give you any impedance you want. That's an extremely well-kept secret. There are guys who think that if I want the impedance of the dipole to go up or down, I've got to go into these fancy delta match, gamma match, fold the dipole match. I've got to do all kinds of fancy mechanical things to get the impedance to be what I want. And that's not true. You go to the article that's written and available to you on the Tom Williams website, RiskyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, WA1MBA.org. You go to that website, the bottom of the page talks about Yagi matching by K2RIW. You click on that thing, and you look at the written article and the two graphs that are given. Let me drop them. You look at the written article and the two graphs that are given, and you realize that as you change the length of the dipole, you're directly changing the resistive component. You can make the resistance component of your dipole, whether it be a dipole in free space or a dipole that's in the middle of a Yagi, doesn't matter. By changing nothing but the length of the dipole wider, you can make the resistive component go from 1 ohm to 1,500 ohms inclusive, anywhere in between. You want it to be 131.5 ohms of resistive component, I'll tell you exactly what length of dipole is going to give that to you. There's a catch. As you choose that magic length of dipole that gives you that exact resistive component you want, 99% of the time there's going to be a reactive component left over. That's the second graph. The reactive component left over is, of course, always undesirable, but you can cancel it. You give me the conjugate reactor right at the center of the dipole, and the reactance goes away. In the ideal world, you'd be putting that compensating reactor in series with the dipole, and in one step you'd have it made. But to put mechanically a series capacitor or a series inductor in series with a dipole is mechanically uncomfortable. You got the dipole wire wrapped around that egg insulator in the center. Let me drop. And you'd like to leave it that way. You don't want to interrupt the wire and plug in the capacitor, if you know what I mean. Because making the capacitor strong enough to take the tension of the wire of the dipole, that's uncomfortable. It can give you a lot of grief. It's hard to believe, but you can use the reactor as a shunting device, not as a series device, and come up with the exact same answer. But now there's interaction between length and reactance. But in a two or three step process, you get there. It's going to take you another 2 minutes. So to make a phony capacitor, to make a gimmick capacitor at the center of your dipole, which is the one that's usually required, is very easy. To adjust the length of the dipole to get the 50.0 ohm resistive component, if that's what you want, or 70.0 ohm resistive component, if that's what you want, that's easy. And you follow that article, and you realize how easy it is to make perfect impedance match of your dipole, assuming it's being fed with the right kind of a balance, and then you've got it made. So you don't have to live with Vizwar. No matter what your antenna is, you readjust the length of the driven element and this reactor in the center, a very simple reactor, and the problem goes away. There's one remaining problem. Let me drop. And that is when you follow this procedure that I'm recommending. In many cases, you will end up with the driven element of a Yagi longer than the reflector. And that drives people crazy. They've been led to believe that a Yagi is only a Yagi if the reflector is longer than the driven element and all the directors are shorter than the driven element. They've been led to believe that that's the way it's got to be. The directors only have to be a certain physical length to act like a capacitor to give you the director action. The reflector only has to be a certain physical length to give you the right amount of inductive reactance so that you get the reflector action. and thoroughly independently you adjust the driven element length to get the impedance you want. And they're separate operations, and they're uncoupled from each other. But if you end up with the driven element longer than the reflector, boy, that drives people crazy. I have watched guys do the tuning procedure that I'm recommending. They were making the driven element longer and longer, adjusting the capacitor in the center. The impedance was getting better and better. They were doing it on an antenna range. The gain didn't change. The pattern didn't change. The impedance match was getting better. They were getting happier and happier. And all of a sudden, as they got close to the end of a solution, the driven element was ending up longer than the reflector, and they wouldn't go there. They stopped. They acted like the antenna was going to explode in their face if they went there. Amazing. When somebody has given you an idea that's burned into your brain, and you can't get around it just because the evidence in front of you is telling you something else is going on. It's kind of amazing how human nature will behave under those circumstances. I've had some heated discussions and multiple emails.
Repeater, timeout.
I've had some heated discussions and multiple emails with people in which I'm trying to lead them into the solution. And they would go halfway and wouldn't go there for fear the antenna is going to explode. It's going to develop some great big, terrible front-to-back ratio or front-to-side ratio. They're going to lose the main lobe gain, the side lobe levels. They're afraid something really bad was going to happen, and they were afraid they weren't going to be able to measure it on their antenna range, and they were afraid to go there. I've seen it on a number of occasions. But you have to accept this as human nature. We've all got our belief system. And if something violates that belief system, it makes us very uncomfortable. And if you're intelligent enough, you've got to be able to adapt to a new situation. That's one of the definitions of intelligence, the ability to adapt to a new environment. And if somebody has presented to you a new environment, a concept for impedance matching, the most basic of all antennas, a dipole, and how this extremely, in my opinion, valuable piece of information has been kept secret from us all of these years. Let me drop. It's amazing to me that this secret piece of information has been kept away from us all these years. And I've tried to get an article on this published, and various publishers think that everybody understands a dipole. This is too boring, and they won't publish it. So I ended up putting it on the bottom of Tom Williams' microwave website. At least it's a place that's available to you. By the same token, how directional couplers work, how that slug inside of a bird wattmeter works. That's an article that got published on the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG.org. And because they rearranged their website these days, all of those nice technical articles are not there. Maybe it's temporary. Hope they're going to be put back. So to find that article that I published there, you may have to go to the so-called Wayback File and go back in time to when it was published, if you know what I mean. And so there are people who consider them good articles. They liked them, and it gave them information they wanted. Anybody got any further questions on this? So the bottom line, let me drop one. I'll give you the bottom line and then pass it over for questions. The bottom line, in my opinion, is that in the general situation, don't be sucked into thinking there's a magic length of transmission line that's always going to make your standing wave ratio go away. There's a ridiculous number of guys out there who have been led to believe that their whole antenna is not going to work well unless the transmission line is some number of exact wavelengths long or some number of exact half wavelengths long, odd or even. There are a ridiculous number of guys who believe that the system is not going to work correctly unless you have a very specific eigenvalue of transmission line length. And the next step they go with that is that when you're using the Bird wattmeter to measure forward and reverse power to try to calculate standing wave ratio, that the readings don't have any meaning unless the transmission line is some exact number of wavelengths long. My goodness, there are people who believe that. And you say some of the words that I just said on the 20-meter man on a Saturday afternoon, and boy, when you start a set of arguments that will eventually end up with strong, salty language, because people have got such strong feelings on these subjects. They've made those changes. They've seen the results. They gave another company an interpretation. And after that, they're positive they know exactly what's going on. And the fact that there was RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable, and the cable was part of the radiating system, and by changing the length of the cable, they were changing the length of the radiator, therefore changing the resonance of the antenna, therefore changing the impedance of the system, and they thought that's what corrects the VISWR. That's a much too simplistic answer and a misjudgment of a measure of a set of measurements. You guys might have some comments or questions on all of the above. K2RIW in the tech network. We'll listen.
WGB with a question.
MCEO Dick, just wanted to say hello and let you know we've been listening since
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, very fine, Rich. Hey, Rich, you're in recovery. You're supposed to be getting your beauty sleep. You're not supposed to be staying up this late and having some fun with Rich. Very fine, Rich. You're sounding good. And John, what more would you like to know about this controversial subject? And if you start preaching this stuff, John, you're gonna be getting some flack. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, I wear my flak jacket all the time, Dick. I'm used to it. But I have a question on the Yagi. Am I to understand from what you just said, I believe this is what you said, that if we have capacitance reaction showing on my Smith chart, I would adjust the directors, and if it's inductive, I would adjust the spacing on the reflector. Is that correct?
Absolutely not, John. A Yagi is a series of directors, and usually a reflector, sometimes two or more. The directors are all tuned shorter than the resonant length, so that they are capacitive. And what the Yagi really is a number of capacitive reactances at a number of specific positions in space along that boom. That's what the Yagi is. You do that with your parasitic elements, and you do have a particular desirable antenna pattern and gain, and front-to-back ratio, and front-to-side ratio, and so on. So there's a set of magic lengths and a set of magical positions for all of the parasitic elements, and that is the design of the Yagi. Do not disturb that. Then you come along with the driven element. The driven element, its only reason in life, let me drop it. The only reason in life is there is to radiate in a dipole-like manner and give you a good balanced impedance match to your transmission line. Now, FINFT, Franck Tonna, got a patent in France because he discovered that if he positions the number one director right in front of the driven element close enough and adjusts the length, he can be making a desirable impedance match to the driven element. He's got a patent on that. He's now a silent key. And in my opinion, yes, it's a patent. Yes, it's something he's done. And yes, it works. But you pay a price. If you're using your parasitic elements as a impedance matching phenomena, you are wasting that beautiful gain pattern that you carefully tuned for the Yagi. Don't disturb it. It's sacred. Do what you've got to do with the length of the driven element all by itself, and putting a shunting capacitor that you add to the center of the driven element in order to get a low reactance, proper resistance, impedance match of the dipole. So you're adjusting the length of the dipole only, and putting a reactor of your addition to the center of the dipole only to make the dipole a good impedance match. Do not disturb any of the parasitic elements. If you had a good Yagi design for those parasitic elements, leave them alone. The gain adjustment and pattern adjustment of a Yagi, let me drop. The gain adjustment and pattern adjustment of a Yagi and the impedance adjustment of the driven element are two completely separate operations. Don't let one contaminate the other. Don't start throwing away some of that beautiful gain as a method of getting the impedance match. You don't have to do that. You can treat the dipole all by itself, the driven element. Is that a little bit more clear, John? KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it is, Dick. I misinterpreted what you said. So the only adjustments should be on the driven part. Leave the others alone on a well-designed Yagi. Okay. I was just wondering, because when I look at my Smith chart, I was wondering what I would see as I moved the directors. Say that there's usually, let's say, three. If I move them, leave the spacing exactly the same, but space it differently from the director as a group back and forth, what I would see on the Smith chart. And I thought that would be a capacitance reactance that I would see from what you were saying, but I misinterpreted it. Very good, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
There's a small degree in truth in what you just said, John. If I've got a well-tuned Yagi, I'm looking at it on a vector network analyzer or some other kind of Smith chart display, or I'm looking at the reflective power on my bird watt meter, and if I now start moving around the directors, I will change the impedance match of the driven element. I'll see the Biswar change. I'll see it move to a different part, a different dot on the Smith chart. That's the truth. Don't use it. If the Yagi design was a good design to begin with, each of those directors are in a particular position, don't move them. Each of their lengths is a particular length, don't change them. And so, when it comes to impedance matching the driven element, work on that all by itself is my strong recommendation. Otherwise, you're allowing one operation to contaminate the other, and you're going to be sacrificing gain or pattern in order to get impedance match because of an erroneous thought that that's the only way you can get it. Now, what I said that created some confusion, let me drop it, was that when you follow my procedure, you will very frequently end up with making the driven element longer because it gives you a better impedance match, and you're going to put a shunt capacitor in most cases in the center to get rid of the reactants as you made the driven element longer to get the right resistive component. See, it's a two-step process. You adjust the length to get the resistance the way you want it. Then you adjust the shunt capacitor in the center to get rid of the remaining reactants. And now you end up with 50 ohms of resistance, 0 ohms of reactants, and you're happy. But when you do that, frequently the driven element ends up longer than the reflector. And in many people's mind, that violates the Yagi principle. They think the Yagi principle is such that driven element must always be shorter than the reflector, or conversely, reflector is always longer than driven element, and director is always shorter than the driven element. There's a degree of truth in that, but in this case, don't overinterpret it, if you know what I mean. The fact that the driven element ends up longer than your reflector, but now you've got a perfect impedance match, and you've got a high-gain Yagi. Be happy. Don't let that worry you. Because the driven element and its radiation like it in a dipole-like manner, and it's good impedance match to your feed line. That's what you're looking for. And there's a very specific length of the reflector to do its reflecting action. Don't change it. There's a very specific length and position for all of the directors. Don't change them. It's my strong recommendation. And that way you'll end up with an optimized Yagi. I mean, people have worried about, is there a particular length for the directors? Let me drop. Is there a particular length of the directors that gives you optimum gain? Well, sort of. Is there a particular position for the directors that give you optimum gain? Sort of. But now if you want an optimum Yagi design, optimum Yagi design. In fact, I gave a speech once in which I entitled it, Optimizing the Process of Optimizing a Yagi. And the answer is, if you've got the right kind of an antenna range, like a ratiometry antenna range, which when set up correctly, and that's the article that was UST Magazine, 1978, I think it was. I forget what month it is, but it's a KQLIW article on the ratiometry antenna range. When you set up a ratiometry antenna range correctly, you can easily resolve 0.05 dB of change, of gain change. Let me drop. A 20th of a dB of gain change you can resolve in a repeatable manner on that antenna range. Once you've got that kind of gain resolution, you now have the ability to tweak the length of each individual Yagi director and tweak the position of each individual director until you optimize the gain. That's what you're looking for. If you want maximum boresight gain, you now can tune each one of these, and it's like a blind man walking up a hill. You know when you're going in the right direction. You know when you're getting benefit because you can see it, and it's there, and it's resolvable and repeatable with the right kind of a ratiometry antenna range. Even though the source of the power that's operating the antenna range is going up and down because Con Ed is increasing and decreasing your voltage and the tube is getting hot and whatever. Doesn't matter when you set up the right kind of antenna range, ratiometry type, where you're continuously comparing the gain of your antenna to a standard gain antenna alongside of it, and you're making the ratio between the two go in the desirable direction because you've got common mode rejection. You set up your whole backyard as an antenna range as a great big operational amplifier, and you're only looking at differential gain. So if the transmitter goes up in power, your reference antenna and the antenna in test both see more power, but the ratio between the two doesn't change. Therefore, the needle on your ratiometry gain indicator doesn't change. So when you do it that way, you now have completely, you have the ability to resolve small gain improvements, and you pile up a whole lot of small gain improvements, and you're going to end up with a darn good antenna. When you do that, all the directors are a different length. All the directors have a slightly different spacing, and that is the optimum design. You're creating a slow wave structure with a particular velocity.
Repeater, timeout.
You're creating a slow wave structure, that's what the directors are, it's a kind of a magnifying glass, with a particular velocity profile. In other words, each foot along the boom, the radio wave travels there at a particular velocity. When you select that velocity profile correctly, all of the energy captured by the Yagi gets focused down to that driven element. You've made the focal length of the magnifying glass equal the length of the boom of the Yagi. All that RF energy gets focused onto the driven element. It goes down the feed line and pegs the S-meter. So when you arrive at that optimum design of the right lengths of the directors and the right positions of the directors, don't change it. Then there's a separate operation, go back and correct the impedance match of the driven element. Okay. You guys have listened to TechNet number, what I think is 1,455. It might be 56. And we hopefully will be back next Sunday because John and Paul and I like this jazz. And after 30 years, we seem to still have a listening audience. So we haven't offended that many people yet, though, John. I do recommend you guys be kind to each other. I've been saying that lately, but don't let the small stuff get you angry. Oh, by the way, it's all small stuff. Let me pass it over to you some comments, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW, the Tech Man.
Very good, Dick. Good explanation. Set up the elements for maximum gain, and then tweak the driven for your match. Okay, sounds logical. I'd like to thank everybody for participating in the net. And Paul, thank you for that great information. And Dick, we'll talk soon. Meanwhile, you enjoy. KC2WGB.
Hey, John. Think Tower. You don't know what you're missing. Paul, you want any further comments about all this? WS2N, K2LIW. And Rich, N2EO. Are you still with us? You're supposed to be getting your beauty sleep. N2EO, K2LIW.
The time is 12 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Thank you. net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Now that you're all decompressed,